Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hey there, friends, and welcome to my favorite part of the afternoon, getting to spend time with you, prescribing hope for healthy families. And here we are. We are just barreling through February. I don't know about you, but it feels like January was 111 days long. It just seemed so long. But here we are going through February, and we have talked about some really important things. And today, I wanted to talk to you about something that's very near and dear to my heart. I want to talk about the presence of children in public life. Now, having children around, children have been part of my life my whole life. I'm the oldest of five kids. I'm the oldest of 12 cousins just on one side. I have a whole bunch more on the other side of my family. I have been a pediatric nurse since I was, before I was really even a legal adult. In some context, I have always taken care of kids. I've always worked in pediatrics. I even worked in a pediatric office before I graduated from high school. I have dedicated my life to really optimizing the health of children. And I have four children of my own. So I'm always thinking about kids. I've worked in a children's ministry, and I've just always had a heart for kids. So that's me for sure. That is not the rest of the world. And I get that. I completely understand that. But it's really interesting to watch, because I feel like since 2025 began, over this last 6 weeks specifically, I am just starting to see children all over media outlets. I'm just seeing more kids. And to be honest, it's kind of jarring, because it really sticks out to me that we weren't seeing that much before. Now, it makes you realize how absent children really have been from the media narrative. And when you do see children, usually it's as some sort of commodity to market or to be marketed to. We're talking about a special skill, a special talent, something that a child invented, which those things are great too, don't get me wrong, but also there is a definite downside to viewing children as a commodity or just marketing to them, because we see the consumer purchasing power of Gen Alpha. I mean, it used to be where companies would have to wait till Saturday morning to market to us on the commercials, but now the marketing is so insidious. It's all the time. And children and companies want children to tell their parents what they want to buy. That's nothing new, but the ways that they are doing it is new. We also might see the ways that we see children most often, I think, just this is my personal perception, not any science or statistics here, but just seeing kids caught in the middle of adult battles or egregiously impacted by adult sins. We see kids who are hurt, who are traumatized, who've experienced something horrible. That's usually going to be a show. And when we look at our country's leadership over the last several years, the honest truth is we see mainly octogenarians, right? We see Nancy Pelosi, who is 84, Mitch McConnell, 82, Maxine Waters, 86, Bernie Sanders, 83. These are just the ages I looked up. That's giving me off the internet. Joe Biden, 82. Charles Grassley, 90. And of course, Dianne Feinstein was 90 when she passed away. And then that makes Donald Trump look like a spring chicken at 78, right? And there are others, but there are a lot of older people. And those people that I just mentioned, they have children who are grandparents and grandchildren who are grown. But all of a sudden, it seems like I'm seeing kids everywhere. I have seen, and likely you've seen a lot of these images too, J.D. Vance carrying his children from a plane in their pajamas. I've seen Elon Musk's son climbing all over his shoulders in the Oval Office. I've seen Carolina Trump holding her grandfather's hand on the track of the Daytona 500. I saw pictures of professional golfer Justin Thomas carrying his tiny little baby girl. I mean, she was itty bitty in his arms after playing in the final round of the Genesis Invitational. I also saw Saquon Barkley, Patrick Mahomes, both with their little kids being interviewed on the sidelines of the Super Bowl. And I've also seen, in contrast to that, I see a narrative. It seems like it really evokes this narrative about kids, because I've seen reports of a Michigan legislator who underwent surgical sterilization so that she wouldn't have to, this is the quote from the news story, navigate a pregnancy in Donald Trump's America. And general sentiment I see expressed towards this generation, I know because they tell me, is that basically adults are telling them, well, this is a terrible time to be alive. But, you know, the honest truth is that each generation has faced its challenges. I mean, what would it have been like to grow up in the Civil War or the Spanish flu, or all over the world, children live in poverty and other afflictions? We live in a broken world. We absolutely do. But we also see the language that we use. Our words have power. And how we talk about children reflects how we value them, and then it instructs them on how to perceive their presence in public spaces. And I know I see this all the time. There was a time, my kids are now a little bit older, but a few years ago, I had four teenagers at one time, and I loved it. I thought it was amazing. I really make it a habit to embrace every stage of parenting. That was advice I got from a mentor early on that I really took to heart. I don't want my kids to feel sad or guilty for growing up, because that's what God designed them to do. So I'm going to embrace every stage. And I embraced this teen year stage. But when I would say I have four teenagers, usually what I would get would be jokes, because we use humor to hide pain sometimes, because teens can be turbulent years. I would get, ooh, this kind of, you know, sound effect. I would get the sympathetic head tilt. I would get, you know, shoulder pats. I would get prayers right on the spot. And then it occurred to me, you know, my children are listening. And so I would have something prepared for whatever stage of parenting I was in. If someone said something negative about it, I'd like, oh, I hated those toddler days. I hated those teen days. I'd say, you know what I love about that? Because I want my kids to hear that. And instead of saying, you know, kids are so annoying, we can say, yeah, kids have a lot of energy. It's a little nicer way to reframe your maybe frustration or inconvenience. But we also hear, you know, dismissive phrases, and we just hear a lot of discouraging language around kids. And there are several ways that I see modern society exhibiting a negative attitude towards kids, because the truth is, if we're really honest, we prioritize convenience and efficiency and adult interest over investing in a future generation. Now, that's a pretty hefty accusation, but it's true. We don't want to be inconvenienced by children. We don't want to, you know, have them slow us down, not let us enjoy the experience that we're having. That is absolutely true. So let me just give you some of these kind of observations that I have as I was reflecting on this. We do view children as inconveniences. Many people see kids as disruptions rather than blessings. And this is evident if you get on a plane. Now, usually someone is not going to sit down next to me and then sigh and say, oh, are you going to be that lady that brings out shrimp that you made from home and then start, you know, eating it on the plane loudly? Are you going to be that annoying person? But you do feel that pressure. I've been that mom on a plane with a little baby where everybody's looking at you like, I don't want to sit there. No. And then you see parents who feel like they have to give gifts around them. They give candy because, please, I'm so sorry if my baby will cry. But we see that in attitudes towards travel or just casual interactions in public. If we have a kid who's misbehaving in a restaurant, in a grocery store, anywhere. And social media posts and comments, they often mock or really express annoyance towards parents. Like, we don't want to deal with a crying baby, a temper tantrum, or a kid who has a lot of energy, who is just going to be maybe perhaps destructive a little bit in that energy, you know, maybe make a mess or something like that. We also see, though, increasing isolation from family and community. The truth is, as we look at how families have changed, families are more fragmented because of busy work schedules, because of digital soothing, which is using digital devices, electronic devices, to soothe our kids rather than using our own words and helping them to self-regulate. And there's just not as many community-based activities because kids are all pursuing their own. We pursue achievement over connection. So often you may find community, and that, I'm not here to say all of these things are bad. I'm just saying these are complex factors that are impacting how kids are growing up today. The other thing to think about is that multi-generational households were once very common, and that gave kids a strong support network. But now a lot of kids grow up away from their extended family, and that can be a challenge. We also have overscheduling and high expectations. This impacts our societal attitude towards kids. Kids are often pressured into a constant cycle. They go to school, they go to extracurriculars, they have achievement-driven activities, you have private lessons or whatever it is. Again, any one of those things is not a bad thing. But when we look at it as a whole, it really is a time, I think, for self-reflection, because do we have enough time for rest, for play, for unstructured creativity? These are the building blocks of resilience for kids. And society often measures kids' worth by their performance rather than just their inherent value as God's creation. We see a decreasing value of traditional family, traditional parenting. We see cultural narratives that undermine the role of parents. And with rise of experts, they say maybe institutions or experts or the internet know better how to raise your children. And you start to feel this imposter syndrome, like, can I do this? Well, yes, you can do this. God gave you your child, your specific child, to raise because he knew exactly the matching that you would need. But sometimes those things can creep in and we start to doubt ourselves. And we think, I have to have a self-help book. I have to have a class. I have to learn how to do this. But there's also a growing emphasis on independence at younger ages. And sometimes we just push kids to make adult-like decisions that they are simply not ready to make. But these are decisions that are impacting what college are they going to go to? What sport are they going to try to play in college? And now especially where I'm seeing just anecdotally on the ground, talking with families who are impacting this, the name, image, licensing changes that are happening in college sports, it increases the potential of financial lucrativeness. And that really does change in the way that our view of that is shaped. It just does. We also have digital overload, unfiltered exposure. Kids are bombarded by screens. Their world is saturated by screens. And that includes really inappropriate material. That includes things that are explicit, things that are violent. That includes unrealistic beauty standards and toxic ideologies, honestly, that can catch on really a lot more quickly than they used to before the advent of influencer culture and social media. And normalizing that excessive screen time, we have collectively in the last generation seen kids' attention span decrease. And we've schooled them, we've taught them how to have an attention span that's about 90 seconds, and it's getting even shorter, looking at real content. And so we have fewer kids who are readers. We have kids who can't sit as long in public spaces because they're used to having a shorter attention span. Of course, we see some hostility towards large families, towards some family values. I know I have experienced that myself, and I don't have what I even think. I have four kids. Like, I think that's pretty normal. But when I go out in public, I will have people ask me if I'm babysitting, or I had a delivery person come to the door once and ask if I was running a daycare. No, this is just my family, and parents of multiple children are sometimes ridiculed or shamed, like, you shouldn't have so many kids. And there's a growing belief that having children is selfish or environmentally irresponsible. And those are narratives that we're encountering. We have a lack of patience and compassion for children's development, seeing temper tantrums, and of course, parents struggling in public. I've been that parent too, where you're just met with glares and judgments and head shaking when sometimes you just made a mistake and you thought you could get in a grocery store run before nap time, and that was a mistake. We also have weakening moral and spiritual foundations. Kids today are raised in a culture where moral relativism is common, and it's harder for them to develop that strong biblical worldview. And we are trying to find places where our kids will have that content reinforced. And we see childhood innocence being taken by cultural forces. And so what I'm going to talk to you about today is a call to talk about a child-friendly culture. How can we welcome children in public spaces? Children, what does God say about children? What is His heart and attitude towards kids? And what can we learn from that? And some practical strategies. Don't go away. I'll be right back. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show. That's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That is why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that is a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies, and that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or 140 helps to rescue 5 babies. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just call #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's 250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Welcome back, friends. That song is Make Room by The Church Will Sing, featuring Alyssa Smith. And I am calling you today to make room for the kids who are around you in public. I am talking today about welcoming kids in public spaces and just embracing kids as part of everyday life and really giving them messages of hope and optimism that they were born for such a time as this, that God ordains their days. And we really need to give them some hope in that, because what I see so often, I cannot tell you how many times I've heard in conversation with kids who are growing up in Gen Z and Gen Alpha saying, adults don't want us around. We're an inconvenience. We're an annoyance. And we're only valuable if we are performing or doing something. Now, of course, now I know that's not true. That's a generalization, but it is a general feeling that a lot of kids have, just feeling like, where is my place? And when we look at a society that disregards or devalues children, I think that we have a society that ultimately weakens itself, because instead of seeing children as obstacles, we should embrace them as gifts from God, ensuring that our homes and our churches and our communities uplift them and nurture them to walk and to carry the faith, to walk in the faith. By fostering faith and patience and compassion, that is where we're going to create a world where children are thriving spiritually, emotionally, and physically. And the children are our future, and we want that to be. So how can we, as Christians, create a culture that values children and supports their faith journey? Well, I think that we can look to no better place than the model that Jesus gave us in His attitude toward children. So as I was looking at this, thinking about this, and praying about this, I came to a passage from Mark. And we have, I'm just going to read it straight to you. It's called, "Let the Children Come to Me." And they were bringing children to Him that He might touch them. And the disciples rebuked them. But when Jesus saw it, He was indignant and said to them, "Let the children come to Me. Do not hinder them, for to such belongs the kingdom of God. Truly I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God like a child shall not enter it. And he took them in his arms and blessed them, laying his hands on them. Now, this word really stood out to me. To be honest, I hadn't noticed it before. Indignant. It said Jesus was indignant at the disciples rebuking people for bringing their children to him. And so I looked up the definition of indignant. It means feeling characterized by or expressing strong displeasure at something considered unjust, offensive, or insulting. So this was a strong displeasure. Now, when we look at righteous indignation, you might have heard that phrase, that is a strong moral anger that is directed at injustice, at wrongdoing, or sin. And that's not rooted in personal offense or selfish frustration, but that's a deep sense of justice aligning with God's standards of justice and righteousness. And that kind of anger is demonstrated all throughout Scripture, particularly in Jesus' actions and teachings. And one of the clearest examples of righteous indignation is when he went and cleansed the temple. And it's that same kind of emotion here. This moment in Mark chapter 10 reveals that children are not an afterthought in God's kingdom. They are not an inconvenience. They are not a burden, but children are central to God's heart. And unlike the societal norms of his time, where children were often overlooked, Jesus welcomed them. I mean, we have to think about the cultural context of that. He affirmed their worth and their innocence as an example of the kind of faith all believers should have. And he had a tender embrace of them. He blessed them to show that every child is precious in his eyes, and his actions challenge us to nurture and protect and uplift the children in our own eyes. When we think about that, they're precious in his sight. They absolutely are. So Jesus' heart for children was to welcome them, to bless them, to value them. And he didn't just tolerate them. He actively blessed them. Jesus elevated their importance and even held them up as an example of true faith. And we see that in the New Testament. Don't let anyone look down on you because you're young, but set an example. And in Matthew chapter 18, he calls a child to himself and he says, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Well, how are we going to be like little children if we don't study them, if we don't see what are those qualities that Jesus was referring to? Because this passage is highlighting the purity, the trust, the humility that children naturally exhibit. But those were qualities that Jesus wanted to see in his followers. Those are qualities that God wants to see in us as his children: purity, trust, humility, curiosity. And to go even further, Jesus issued a very strong warning against leading children astray. If this doesn't tell you about God's heart, in Matthew 18:6, he says, "If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned into the depths of the sea." And so whether those are children or young believers, this sobering statement really emphasizes his fierce protection over children and underscores the responsibility of adults to nurture and guide them in righteousness. Now, Jesus not only welcomed children, but he also healed them because he cared for their well-being. In Luke chapter 8, he raises Jairus' daughter from the dead, one of my favorite stories, because when in that story, we learn how Jesus was actually derailed by a woman who was bleeding, and he stops to heal her and thinking about Jairus' father, thinking, "No, come, you said that you would come with me," and then getting there and she's already dead. But it's only so God could show a greater work. He tenderly took her by the hand and said, "My child, get up, little girl, get up." He also cast out an unclean spirit from a boy. And these acts of healing just reveal that Jesus was not only interested in their spiritual condition, but he also cared about their physical and emotional well-being, just like we should today. And through his words and action, Jesus consistently valued kids. He blessed kids. He protected kids. And he called them an essential part of God's kingdom. And his example should really challenge us. We need a society that cherishes kids, that nurtures kids, that helps them and encourages them as they're growing in faith and love and security, as they're growing in wisdom and stature and favor, right? God sees and loves us as his children too. And I think it's kind of ironic how there are, you know, some people who maybe don't have the most positive feelings toward children, but they want to be a child of God. You know, we want, there is something in the heart of us as humans that longs for that fatherly affection, that parental affirmation. And God does see and love you as his child with a deep and unconditional, very protective love. He wants a close relationship with you, just like a loving parent longs for their child. And throughout scripture, he repeatedly affirms his role for us. As our Heavenly Father, he offers us his guidance, his discipline, his provision, his grace. I mean, we see, think about God's love for us as his children, okay? He loves us as his children unconditionally. What great love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called the children of God. And that is what we are. I mean, it's exclamation point, exclamation point. It is meant to be emphasized that God's love is not based on what we do, but on his own nature. He loves us fully. He loves us freely. He also gives us fatherly care and provision. Matthew 7, this is another one of my favorites. If you then, though you are evil, and we are hopelessly flawed, but we know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? And that reminds us, God is not distant way out there. He is not uncaring. He is not disengaged. He is a provider who wants to meet our needs. But just as a loving parent disciplines their child for good, God corrects us to refine our character. We know in Hebrews 12 that it states, "The Lord disciplines the one he loves, and he chastens everyone he accepts as his son." So his discipline is not punishment, but it's love that shapes us into the people that he created us to be. And maybe most heartwarming, we are adopted. We have security. When we accept Christ, we're not just servants, we're not just followers, we are fully adopted as a child into God's family. Romans 8 says, "The Spirit you received does not make you slaves so that you live in fear again. Rather, the Spirit you received brought about your adoption to sonship. And by him we cry, Abba, Father." That is direct access to the name to God, which is really amazing. So having said all of that, we know what God thinks about kids. Let's look and see what America thinks about kids. I want to give you a little generational perspective on attitudes towards kids in America, because over the past 200 years, which is really not that much time when you think about it, American culture has really gone through some drastic shifts in how children are viewed and raised. So we have in the 1800s, children were little adults. They were expected pretty early on to contribute to family survival through labor, and the family and faith were deeply intertwined into that. They were expected to work, to contribute, but also to be seen and not heard. And faith and discipline were rigid and often fear-based. Now, then when we see the 1900s, we see the rise of childhood as a special season. It really wasn't that so much before. And this was brought about by factors like the Industrial Revolution and public education that transformed childhood. And it created a structured approach to child rearing. We have the preschool years. We have them going to school. We have them graduating and entering the workforce or going to college. And as education expanded, we had child labor laws enacted to protect kids. And we saw a little bit of a shift toward a more nurturing approach, yet there were still very strict societal expectations, right? And then we have the mid to the late 20th century. That's the children first movement. We saw a rise of technology. We saw shifting family dynamics that changed the focus to achievement, to independence. We see the rise of modern parenting philosophies, which I'm going to talk about. And we see in the generational shift, just in the last 100 years, we see from the greatest generation, which of course they were great. They saved the world from tyranny, but they also, many of them experienced unimaginable horrors, either directly in the face of war or at home, vicariously through those they loved. There was no one who was untouched. And so children were raised to be seen and not heard. We had the silent generation following that. And I think intuitively, instinctively, they learned to be quiet so they would not trigger the traumas of their parents that they had experienced because they were taught to be stoic, that you just bear your burden and you march on. And there are things that are admirable about that, and there are things that are hurtful about that. And so then we see the silent generation giving rise to the baby boomers who were in search of love. And then they raised Gen X, who are latchkey kids, and said, okay, we can do everything on our own, but hey, maybe we want to be more connected to our kids. And so they raised millennials who love their parents, but are mocked for it. And then now we have Gen Z and Gen Alpha, and we see that the pendulum swinging in the opposite direction. And we see Gen Z and Gen Alpha facing challenges we never have faced before as parents. Now, we faced the emotional and social kind of core issues, the emotions that are behind that, the sin that is behind that, but the way that it's delivered, the cultural context is different. We have digital saturation, of course, the rise of screens. We have identity struggles. We have a loneliness epidemic. We have a mental health crisis. We have people deconstructing their faith and walking away. They're cynical. And they're sick of the hypocrisy. They're sick of not being able to get their questions answered. And they need engaged, faith-filled adults to help walk them through that. There is a misperception thinking, oh, you don't understand what I'm going through. But yes, you do. As an older generation, you've been through hardship, you've been through trials, you've been through trauma, and you are here to tell the tale if you're sitting here listening. Those stories and characteristics of resilience, especially when they're in the context of my family, like my grandmother did this, my grandfather did this, my great-grandfather did this, maybe I can do this too. We need to be engaged and give messages of hope and optimism for future generations. Our kids are growing up in a world that is increasingly uncertain. And we see that anything can happen at any moment, all of the world's bad news. So here are some messages of hope that we can give them. We can remind them of their God-given worth, that God created them, formed them in their mother's womb. We can teach them to see the world through a biblical lens. And we are doing that here on Worldview Wednesdays this year. We're having selected Wednesdays where we talk about that. We can encourage resilience and say, God knows the plans that he has for you, plans to harm you, not to prosper you, not to give you a hope and a future. And we can model joy-filled, authentic faith and talk about these things as we walk along the road and just make faith an everyday part of our life. A child embracing society isn't about inclusion. It's about nurturing their spiritual formation in a world that seeks to pull them away from their faith. We can also tell them from Psalm 100 that God is faithful through every generation. He is faithful to keep his promises. And we can teach them that biblical hope isn't passive. It's just not sitting there, well, I hope things get better tomorrow. It's an active confidence in God's plan for them, his love for them. And we can raise children with purpose, instilling faith and courage and love for others. Well, when we come back, I'm going to talk to you about some practical strategies for embracing children in society. What is the role of the church? What is the role of community? And what is the healthiest parenting style? I'll tell you that when we come back after this break.
We live in a day when America's families are under attack like never before.
Buddy Smith, Senior Vice President of the American Family Association.
The war against biblical principles rages on numerous fronts. The internet, Hollywood, Washington, D.C., America's corporate boardrooms, and the list goes on. At American Family Association, we're committed to standing against the enemies of God, the enemies of your family. And we recognize it's an impossible task without God's favor and your partnership. Thank you for being faithful to pray for this ministry, to give financially, and to respond to our calls for activism. What you do on the home front is crucial to what we do on the battlefront. We praise God for your faithfulness, and may he give us many victories in the battles ahead as we work together to restore our nation's biblical foundations.
See my hands and look at my feet. It's okay if it's hard to believe. my time to go. But before I leave, go tell the world about me. For I was dead, but now I live. I've gotta go now for a little while. But goodbye.
Well, hello, friends. That is The Commission by Kane, where we're told to tell the world about the good news of Jesus. And today, I'm talking specifically about carrying that message to children, to welcoming children into public life and public spaces. Now, there is a balance here. Don't hear me say that I think you should never say anything about any misbehaved child. I am not saying that at all. There's definitely a balance, and I'll talk about those in practical strategies. But I am talking about doing a gut check on our attitude towards kids and thinking about the messaging that we're giving to them. We want them to know that this is the time, this is a good time to be alive. And God created you for such a time as this. We don't want to say things like I hear all the time, oh, I'm so glad I raised my kids in a different generation. I'm so glad I don't have kids today. And that may be a sentiment that you have because, yes, there were things that I look back on in my childhood with great nostalgia. And I wish so much I could raise my kids in a world with no social media, a world where they have to be home when the streetlights are on and they drink out of the water hose and they're not afraid to explore. And those kinds of things, but we need to be thoughtful in our messaging. So let me give you some practical strategies for how do we welcome children in society. Well, I think that the role of church and community is really important for families. We need to encourage multi-generational relationships. There is something so absolutely precious about seeing a very young kindergarten age kid having a conversation with an octogenarian, with somebody who is in their 80s, just having those different life experiences, but finding common ground. I did this on our Christmas Eve family gathering. We had way across the spectrum as far as age and stage and life experience. And so I got some conversation cards and passed them out. Now, you have to know when you do things like that, people don't say, oh, what a wonderful idea. Oh, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to this. Nope. They look at you with awkward grins. They kind of say, really? They tilt their head. They express their skepticism. And then they have the best conversation they've had in ages. So you just got to push through that awkwardness sometimes and just be that person and that personality that just makes that happen. But church needs to be a welcoming place for kids. I've mentioned before, I recently got back from a conference of children's ministers, and it was so life-affirming to see their mission was to make church a welcoming, safe place for kids. Really celebrate and affirm children's presence in worship, even when sometimes they're not always the best behaved. That's okay. Learn when to give grace. Those parents have their kids there in church, and that is something to affirm. And maybe if you're sitting by the same misbehaving kid, maybe you can bring them a Bible story page to color or something like that, something where you can make a gesture of kindness. But there are some practical ways to support their faith journey just by creating those child-friendly church spaces, making sure that children feel welcome in worship and they see that, hey, we planned for you. We want you to be here. And faith is best cultivated at home, of course, but having that wraparound family support in the church so they can bring their kids, that's really important because if kids are not feeling, if they don't have a place to go, how are the parents going to go into Bible study? That can be really, really difficult. And you can be spiritual mentors. Every kid needs more than just parents. They need a community of faith-filled adults to guide them and to invest in them, to encourage critical thinking in their faith, to ask them questions about God and the world, equipping them with biblical truth rather than just dismissing their doubts and telling them why they shouldn't think that way. That and engaging in service together is another great way to engage with kids. It's amazing what kids can do and what they can contribute. Now, when we talk about and we want kids to be welcome in church, But let's talk about the home, because that is the primary place where all of the important stuff is happening. And there has been so much talk about healthy parenting styles and boundaries. We need to balance discipline and grace. We need to discipline our kids. We need to make sure they know their manners, that they know how to behave in a church service, at a restaurant table, those kinds of things. But we also need to recognize that they are human. And sometimes we have trouble with our emotions or our behavior, and we need to make sure that we are pursuing their heart rather than controlling their behavior. Because sometimes we care more about the behavior because that's an instant gratification saying, number one, you're doing a great job as a parent because your child is behaving. And number two, look at you. You're doing a great job as a parent. Everybody look at me. My child is perfect. Oh, yes, that's me. Because we feel the opposite when our children aren't perfect. Go after their heart, not their behavior. Don't take a singular behavioral struggle and make it into a general characterization of their essence, of their spirit, of their character. They can be good kids who have temporary struggles, and that's important. So we need to set clear expectations. We need to set consequences and follow through on those. We need to teach them to self-regulate, not just obey. Yes, we want them to obey us for sure, but we're not going to be there for their whole lives. So at some point, that's got to transition where they self-regulate, and it's not just an authoritarian dictator demand, right? We've got to find ways to reinforce those biblical values in everyday life through relationship. But having those boundaries is important because it helps kids to feel secure. It helps them to develop godly character. So we want to have a parenting style that is biblical, that balances discipline and grace, just as God does with us, that teaches good manners. We see Ephesians 4:32, right? Be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving each other as God forgave you. And understanding their developmental needs, recognizing that sometimes it's not defiance, it's just their brain growing. So I told you that I was going to tell you the most effective, the healthiest parenting style. And actually, this has stayed true for a long time. The healthiest parenting style is actually, are you ready? I feel like we need a drum roll. Authoritative parenting. Okay, I'll say it again. It is just widely recognized as the most effective approach. If you want well-adjusted, confident kids who are grounded in their faith, authoritative parenting is for you. It balances high expectations. Yes, I have high expectations for you, but I also love you. And I'm going to guide you, and I'm going to support you, and I'm going to create an environment where you feel secure and challenged to grow. You feel secure enough to fail. Some of those key characteristics of authoritative parenting, because you're wondering, am I an authoritative parent? Do you have high expectations, but with emotional support? So you've got clear boundaries, but you also have a good relationship. You feel like, yep, my kids know what I need to do, but I also feel really close to them. I know what they're thinking. I know their dreams, their fears, their hopes, their aspirations. I know those things. Another question to ask yourself, do you consistently discipline with explanation? So you enforce the rules. The rules are consistent, but I'm also taking time to explain them to you, even though it seems like I've explained it 14,000 times now. It takes them a while to learn. We don't learn everything on the first try. Here's another question for you. Do you encourage independence? Do you encourage critical thinking? Children need to be given age-appropriate autonomy. They need to be encouraged to make decisions within a safe framework. So when we look at age-appropriate autonomy, we see the pendulum swinging, and now parents do everything for their kids. I will never forget. I was at my kid's school, and I saw another mom there, and she was there to bring food from a restaurant. And then the next day, I was at the school, and I saw her there with a salad. And my son said, yeah, she brings him food every day, because if he brings a salad in the morning, then it's wilty. And, you know, he wants to be fresh and crisp by lunch. And I remember thinking, Oh, wow. We've come a long way from bologna sandwiches that are wrapped in foil, right? Like, we've come a long way. And there's some good things to be said for that. There's some ways that we've improved on nutrition. I'm not saying bologna is healthy. It's really not healthy. But we have to think about, are we giving our kids autonomy? Are we making their lives too comfortable? They need to experience a little frustration. They need to experience failure in a safe and supportive way so that they learn to self-regulate their behavior, to bring their lunch to school. We also need to have open communication. Here's a question for you, and we'll be talking about this coming up in the Healthy Habits. Do you listen with your face? Do you listen with your face? Do you listen to their thoughts and their feelings, or do you lecture? Do you lead with lecture or do you lead with listening? Listening to them really helps us to figure out, where are you? I need to meet you where you are. I can tell you where I expect you to be, but that's like if we went and gave our kids a Rand McNally, they would be lost. They would be not even know how to use that. And that's how they feel when we tell them, oh, this is how you need to make this decision, and this is how you need to handle this situation. It's intuitive to us, but it's not intuitive to them. And even if we don't like where they are, we've got to meet them there so we can be their guide on the side. Last question, do you balance your approach to correction and praise? And really, in balancing it, do you have 10 times as much praise as you have correction? Do you correct mistakes with grace? Do you celebrate achievements without fostering entitlement? Do you celebrate who they are as much as what they do? And these are some of the things that make authoritative parenting the most effective. Saying, I'm in charge. You can trust me. I love you. I am here for the best for you. And my kids will make fun of me a little bit because this is what I'll tell them. If they don't like a rule that we have, I'll just be very calm because our job is to help them emotionally regulate. They should match our emotions, not theirs, but sometimes it's tempting. And I've learned to tell them, you know, you can fight me on this, but I'm stronger than you. I'm older than you. I'm wiser than you. I'm tougher than you. I have more resources than you. I have more wisdom than you. Frankly, I have more skin in this game. So if you're going to be upset, I'm okay with that. This is still the way that it's going to be. So how do we balance that? But it took me a long time. It took me a long time to learn how to do that. But studies show that children raised with authoritative parenting, they've got strong self-discipline. They can emotionally regulate. They've generally got good self-esteem. They can be resilient when they face trauma or trials. They generally perform better academically and socially. They've got a strong moral compass. They've got a good sense of personal responsibility. And they feel secure in their parents' love. And it makes them unlikely to seek validation, to seek love in other ways. And let me tell you, the world is throwing many, many options their way where they can feel love and validated. And this is so hard in that competing messaging, because when a child, especially thinking about a teenager, when they make a choice to do something that is against your family values, that is against their spiritual beliefs, many times the world will tell them, you're so brave, you're so awesome, you're so cool, you're so whatever the word is, you know, you are not a skibbity Ohio whatever Gen Alpha lingo is, right? Okay, I lost some of you there, but that's okay. That's the messages that they're getting when the messages they get from us are, how could you do that? What were you thinking? Did I raise you like that? You're going to ruin your life. So we really have to think about the messaging. That's not to say that we change the boundary, but we change the way that we enforce the boundary. We change the messaging around the boundary, saying, I love you. Here is the boundary. Here are the consequences. Now, what can I do to help support you to make the choices that you need? What resources do you need? And that style really aligns with biblical principles of we want our kids to grow up in a healthy relationship. We want to have a healthy authority. We want to have healthy boundaries. And that style really aligns with those biblical principles of disciplining with love. My child whom I love, I discipline. And reflects God's approach to us as his children. It models the way that Jesus taught, being firm in truth, but overflowing with grace. So Can we raise our kids with love and wisdom? Yes, we can. It really balances God's reflection of justice and grace. He sets boundaries for us. He disciplines us in love. He encourages us to grow. And we want to have kids who are secure, who are resilient, who are not fear-based, who are faith-filled and prepared for adulthood. So here's some practical takeaways for you. I think I'll talk about this more on Friday. I have more to say on the matter, but just set some clear, loving boundaries while explaining the why behind the rules. Discipline with grace and consistency, not anger or fear. Encourage independence and critical thinking and faith. Foster open, trusting relationships with your kids and model those things that you want to see in leading by example. And most of all, trust God to guide your parenting, relying on prayer and biblical wisdom and those 52 habits for healthy parenting. If you've missed out on those, go to the Dr. Nurse Mama Coaching Minutes and I'll walk you through the building blocks for success for healthy relationships in your family. May the Lord bless you and keep you, and make his face shine upon you, and I'll see you here tomorrow.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.